Buonasera, grazie innanzitutto per la puntualità. È molto raro che un incontro di questo genere cominci così puntuale, ma del resto sarebbe perfettamente assurdo ritardare semplicemente in omaggio alla norma non scritta del quarto d'ora accademico, dal momento che la sala è già così piena. Mi fa particolarmente piacere che la sala sia così piena oggi, perché per me e per l'Istituto Bruno Leoni è veramente una bellissima occasione avere con noi David Friedman. Io sono, devo dire, particolarmente felice questa sera perché, dal mio punto di vista, se sono qua a presentarvi il professor Friedman è anche, forse soprattutto, in ragione del suo libro più noto, che è L'ingranaggio della libertà, un libro degli anni 70 tradotto in Italia a inizio anni 90 grazie al formidabile impegno di Liberi Libri di Aldo Canovari, che è stato, lo confesso, il mio primo libro liberale e libertario. Ed è anche stato, perlomeno per me, una lettura straordinaria, perché, come sapranno bene quelli fra voi che hanno avuto occasione di leggerlo in passato, è un libro divertentissimo, estremamente vivace, accattivante, meravigliosamente logico e concatenato nel modo in cui presenta un'ipotesi coerente e innovativa di società senza Stato, insomma, di un mondo nel quale la libertà individuale non sia più neanche minimamente oppressa da strutture coercitive. Alcune copie di questo libro, che grazie a Canovari e a Liberi Libri è un classico di quelli perpetuamente raggiungibili, sempre in catalogo, sono disponibili all'entrata. Per quelli di voi che non l'abbiano letto, è veramente una magnifica lettura, ve la raccomando. Per quelli che invece l'hanno già letto, ma magari si sono dimenticati la loro copia a casa, è un'occasione per averne una autografata al professor Friedman, che sarà lieto di autografare i libri a fine dell'incontro. Il tema di oggi è fortemente vicino allo spirito di quel libro. David Friedman è un economista, si è formato a Chicago, insegna all'Università di Santa Clara, ma è da sempre molto attento, come del resto è anche tradizione di alcuni esponenti della scuola di Chicago, a questioni di carattere giuridico. Si può dire che egli rappresenta un approccio estremamente conseguente e lineare, ma minoritario all'interno della grande famiglia della Law and Economics, e anche per questa ragione siamo particolarmente felici di averlo qui in un istituto che è intitolato dopo tutto a Bruno Leoni. Quindi le cose si avvicinano molto. Doppiamente, triplamente felici di averlo qui siamo, per l'appunto, per il titolo del discorso di questa sera. La sua lezione di questa sera si intitola Diritto senza Stato, che, come potrete facilmente immaginare se conoscete più ancora che l'attività del nostro istituto, il pensiero e l'opera di Bruno Leoni, un tema tipicamente e fortemente leoniano. Il modo in cui verrà declinato in questa sede sarà sicuramente originale e brillante, come è costume del professor Friedman, al quale cedo senza ulteriore indugio la parola, chiedendovi soltanto di unirvi a me nel dargli un caldo benvenuto. Grazie.
Let me start by apologizing for the fact that I am giving this talk in English. My only excuse for doing so is that if I attempted to give it in Italian, I would owe you a larger apology for the hash I would make of La Bella Lingua. Almost everyone is a conservative. That is to say, almost everyone implicitly assumes that however the world is currently functioning is the way it always will function and probably always has functioned. And my purpose this evening is to try to argue that that is not necessarily the case. And in particular, that the things which are routinely done by government and that almost everyone takes it for granted must be done by government can be done, in many cases have been done, in other ways. And there are three different versions of law without government I'm going to discuss tonight. The first is property. The second is the enforcement of contracts. And the third is law in general, in particular tort law and criminal law. And I want to start with property because it is a claim one often sees that property is simply a creation of the state, and that therefore if the state decides to seize your property or regulate what you can do with it, you really have no complaint because you would have no property if the state wasn't giving it to you anyway. And that claim is demonstrably false. It is demonstrably false because property not only predates the invention of the state, it predates our species. A primitive form of property is routinely observed in the behavior of animals. And I will argue that property among humans is simply a much more elaborate and sophisticated version of the same arrangement. Property among animals is referred to as territorial behavior. It is common among many species of birds and fishes, some mammals, and it works as follows. An individual of the species in some way marks out its claim, marks out the territory that it claims belongs to it, and it then somehow turns a switch in its brain, how we don't know, such that it will fight any trespasser more and more desperately the farther into its territory the trespasser comes. Unless two animals are very different in size and strength, a fight to the death is a loss for both. Hence, once the trespasser knows that the property claimant really is committed to fight as hard as necessary, it is almost always in the trespasser's interest to retreat. Hence, such property claims are in fact enforced. So that is a form of property. It's a very primitive form of property. You can't sell it. You can't make easements on it. You can't mortgage it, but nonetheless, it is a piece of land or a piece of the bottom of the sea or a piece of a tree, depending on the animal, which is effectively the property of one individual. And what is enforcing it is a commitment strategy. The fact that somehow the animal has set things up so that it is committed to fight more than it's worth, as it were, in order to defend it. And in my view, quite a lot of the characteristic of modern human societies involves a fancier version of that same pattern. Imagine that you live in some suburban neighborhood where the local government is not very competent. And one day, your neighbor calls to you over the fence and he says, "I have an idea. It's a real nuisance taking my trash to the dump every week. So I'm going to start dumping it over the fence onto your property instead." And you know, and I know, that the local government is sufficiently incompetent and clumsy so that getting them to do anything about it is going to be more trouble than it's worth. But I've got an alternative to offer. Pay me $10 a month and I won't. And the question is, why do you turn down that very reasonable offer? I think all of you predict that you will turn down that offer. And the answer is the same reason that the fish or the bird does. That is to say, you have in your mind an invisible set of borderlines. Some of them are in property and some of them are in other places, defining what you see as your rights. And you have somehow turned a switch in your brain so that you are willing to fight in defense of those rights, not infinitely hard. You'll surrender if a mugger has a gun and obviously you can't fight him. But you're willing to bear considerably larger costs than the amount at stake in order to defend what you see as your rights. And you might bear those costs by punching somebody. You might bear them by suing him. You can imagine lots of different ways in which this pattern of behavior exists in a species as complicated as ours. But the basic logic of what's going on is the same. And in my view, this is the answer to a question that I think more people ought to ask. And that is, in what way are we ever out of the Hobbesian state of nature? All right? Thomas Hobbes famously described the state of nature as the war of each against all and a very, very miserable condition. And the question is, why aren't we in it? And you say, well, if I sneak up on you and kill you when you're asleep, the police will arrest me. Why will they? The policemen are just people like everybody else. Why aren't they a part of the war of each against all? The judge will convict me. Why is the judge different? Putting a uniform on somebody or a wig on a British judge doesn't change what he is. So why is it that our state of nature is so much more orderly and peaceful than Hobbes? And I think the answer is that what a society is a network of mutually recognized commitment strategies. I think of this as a positive account of rights. All right, rights are usually thought of either as a moral category, it is wrong to violate them, or as a legal category. I want to think of them as a positive category, as a description of how human beings actually behave. So that when I say I have a right to something, most of what I mean is that other people will usually not find it in their interest to violate that right, for whatever reason. And quite often, the reason is not because the police will stop them, but because I will stop them. Because they believe that violating that result will result in my doing things they don't like, sufficient so they don't. So then I think if you look at how societies function, modern societies, past societies, part of what's going on is that everybody knows the commitment strategies of everybody else. Everybody knows that there are certain things in this society which if you try to do to people, they will forcibly resist, and that gives ultimately the structure and the pattern to a society. And that is true with or without a state. At some point, someone pointed out to me an interesting example of the pattern of behavior, very much like the animal pattern, existing not only in a modern city, but in the city where I grew up, namely Chicago. I had not myself observed it, but apparently the following happens. There, in Chicago, it snows. I don't know how familiar you are with snow, but we get quite a lot of it in Chicago. And one result when it snows a lot is if you want to park your car, you have to shovel out a parking space. And apparently, after someone has shoveled out a parking space and pulls out of it to go somewhere, he leaves some mark, like the animal marking his territory. He leaves a chair or something sitting in that parking space. And this is announcing, this is my parking space. I'm the one who shoveled it out. I expect it to be empty when I come back. And if it isn't empty when I come back, the car that is there may get a broken window or some scratched paint or have something else unpleasant happen to it. All right, so that's an interesting example. It's illegal. So it's not only not property enforced by the state, it's property enforced by violating state laws, and yet nonetheless it results in a form of very temporary property of what has temporarily become a scarce good. So that's property. Let me go on to speak about contract. And what I want to talk about is how contracts are enforced without government enforcement. And to begin with, that's a subject that should be of interest to all lawyers at present, including the students I teach at a law school, because if you're a good lawyer, your customer never goes to court. Part of being a good lawyer is drawing up a contract in such a way that you won't have to sue, in such a way that neither party will want to violate it. But there are some other interesting examples which I've looked at. The book I'm currently working on is a book on legal systems very different from ours. And it covers a very wide range of legal systems, some of them ancient, some of them currently existing. And the basic theory of the book is that all societies face about the same problems and solve them in an interesting variety of different ways. And since there's no particular reason to believe that we're smarter than other people at other times and places, it's worth taking their solutions seriously. They might be good, they might be bad, but they probably make some sort of a logical sense and we ought to understand. One of the societies I've looked at is Imperial China. China, the legal system that existed for about 2,000 years until roughly 1900. It turns out that about 1900, China ceded the island of Formosa, Taiwan, to Japan. And the Japanese decided that instead of trying to impose Japanese law on a Chinese population, they would enforce existing Chinese law. And in order to do that, they had to find out what it was. So there was an extensive scholarly project by a bunch of Japanese scholars 100 years ago to research Chinese law in Taiwan. And the result survived, and I've read an account of part of it in English. I don't read Japanese. I read less Japanese than Italian even. And one of the interesting parts is that Imperial Chinese law contained essentially no contract law. In fact, as far as I can tell, it really contained nothing corresponding to our civil law. If I lent you money and you didn't pay it back, my only legal recourse was to go to the district magistrate and accuse you of being a swindler. That's a criminal charge. The district magistrate could choose to ignore it. He could tell you, pay him half the money and we'll forget it. He could tell you pay him all the money, or he can tell you I don't care if you pay the money, I don't like swindlers, I'm going to have you punished. So you have no control over the case, unlike an ordinary contract case under our legal system. Furthermore, there was very nearly no contract law. There were rules on maximum interest rates which were routinely violated, but not much else. Despite which, the Chinese merchants in Taiwan engaged in elaborate contractual practice. They made contracts, they bought and sold across the Taiwan Strait, so it wasn't all the people they knew. And the interesting question is, how did they do it? And one of the reasons this question interests me is that, in my view, this situation is being recreated online. It is relatively hard to use state legal mechanisms to enforce arrangements online, because on the internet, national boundaries are transparent. You can even, if you like, arrange to do business with people while maintaining your anonymity, in which case it's really hard to sue you. So the question is, how do you enforce contracts in that context? And I have an article, which you can find on my webpage, called From Imperial China to Cyberspace, which is discussing the ways in which the Chinese did it and how those apply to the ways in which people are doing it or will be doing it online. So how do you arrange contract? How do you enforce contracts without the state? And there are two underlying mechanisms and then a bunch of tricks that make it easier. And the first mechanism is what economists refer to as the discipline of constant dealing. If you're dealing with the same person over a long period of time, you know that if you cheat him today, he'll refuse to do business with you tomorrow. If doing business with him is useful, you therefore don't cheat him. And I think if you think about a lot of our own relationships, you deal with stores, you deal with other people on a basis of trust, at least in northern Italy. I'm told it doesn't work as well in southern Italy, on the grounds that these are repeat players and therefore they will behave themselves. The second and slightly more complicated mechanism is reputational enforcement, that people keep their contracts because they want to maintain a good reputation. And it's sort of interesting if you try to think through the economic logic of reputational enforcement. I buy a sports jacket from a store that says, if you don't like it, money back, no questions asked. I bring it home. My wife points out that purple is not my color and 46 large is not my size. And I take it back to the store. And the question is, why do they keep their agreement? Why do they give me my money back? Probably not because they think I'll sue them. It's not a large enough sum to be worth going to court for. But they want to keep me as a customer, and they want to keep everybody I talk to as a customer. And if people believe they don't keep their deals, they'll be reluctant to deal with it. So the next question is, if they hadn't done it, why would my friends and my enemies stop dealing with that store? I say and my enemies, because the people who stop dealing with the store aren't doing it for my sake. They aren't doing it to punish the store for cheating me. They're doing it to protect themselves from getting cheated. All right? And that has an interesting implication. It means that if you want reputational enforcement to work, you have to make it easy for interested third parties to find out who is at fault. All right? If you imagine that imagine it's an ordinary contract, and I claim you broke the contract, what is the response of third parties who might want to do business with one of us in the future? If they can't tell whether I'm telling the truth, their conclusion is that either you cheated me or I cheated you, and therefore they would be wise not to do business with either of us. Since I know that's how they'll react, when you cheat me, I don't announce it, because it'll only hurt me. So that means that for reputational enforcement to work, you have to set things up so that the cost to interested third parties of finding out who is at fault is low. Then the interested third parties figure out who cheated and avoid doing business with him in the future, and that's a reason not to cheat people. That's the basic logic of reputational enforcement. And I would argue that one of the functions of arbitration institutions, which exist with or without state enforcement in lots of contexts, of neutral third-party arbitrators, is to lower information costs to third parties. So imagine that you and I make a contract, and we specify in the contract that it's to be arbitrated by the American Arbitration Association, which is a real organization. I think you violated the contract. You refuse to compensate me. We go to arbitration. And the arbitrator announces that I was in the right, you were in the wrong, and you refused to make it good. Now, all a third party has to do is to check the arbitrator's opinion and he knows with reasonable confidence, because they both agreed in advance, who is at fault. So I think that's a way of making sense of the institutions of arbitration. And online, there's a very elegant way of doing it. If we had another half hour, I would explain all about how encryption, in particular, two-key encryption, secret key encryption, private key encryption works. But the basic fact is that there are known technologies by which I have a secret piece of information called my private key. So does anybody else who's working with this system. And using that piece of information, I can sign a document in a way that proves it was signed with my private key, even though nobody else has my private key. Other people have the matching public key, and if you have the public key, you can recognize the work of the private key, even though you can't reconstruct the private key. That's a very short description of technical stuff, which we can, if people want, we can explain more in the discussion. So what that means is that you and I can sign a can write a contract online. We can include in that contract the public key of the arbitrator, who we've agreed on, and we can then sign it using our private keys. Any third party who knows our public keys, which are public information, like your phone number, can check that both of us signed that contract. If you violate the contract, and I go to the arbitrator and ask him for a judgment, and the arbitrator says, yes, he was the bad guy, and he refused to compensate. The arbitrator then signs that verdict, and I put it on a web page with your name all over it, where anybody who is looking for information about you will find it, and it takes his computer half a second to verify that that opinion was signed by the arbitrator who both of us agreed to arbitrate the dispute. So it's a very low-cost mechanism that makes arbitration online possible. It's not necessary that you know who I am or that I know who you are, that anybody knows who the arbitrator is, only that the two of us knew that he had a reputation such that he could be trusted. Right. So let me go on to discuss how you design a contract in order to minimize the need to rely on enforcement mechanisms. And the first one is that you try to design it so that at any point in time, either party will be worse off if he pulls out. So imagine I'm hiring somebody to build me a house. If I pay him in advance and we don't have enforceable contracts, I never see him again. If he builds the house in advance, I may decide to renegotiate the price when he finishes. So the sensible thing to do in that context is to pay him gradually over the time the house is being built at such a point that it, in such a way that if at any stage one of us pulls out, both of us are better off, not just one. Now, you can't always do this because the world is an uncertain place and costs and benefits can change over time. You can try to do it. And in particular, if you have a contract which currently looks as though at some point over time it will be in my interest to pull out, one solution is that I give you a deposit. That then shifts the benefits in such a way that it's no longer in my interest to pull out. But of course, it makes it more in your interest to pull out. So sometimes, if you imagine graphing what happens over time with some uncertainty, there are cases where there's no schedule of payments, which will guarantee that neither person wants to pull out. Well, one solution to that is to replace the deposit with a hostage. A hostage is something I give you, which it hurts me to lose, but it doesn't benefit you to get. So it doesn't give you an incentive to renege on the contract in order to seize it, but it gives me an incentive to keep the contract. And indeed, one could argue that criminal law in Taiwan was a hostage. That is to say that my hostage is that if you do cheat me, I can accuse you of being a swindler, and that'll hurt you even though it won't help me. Now, again, I could talk at greater length. If I had unlimited time, I have a wonderful hostage story from England in the 12th century about a man who, a very famous Englishman who as a child was offered as a hostage by his father, who then reneged on the deal, but the guy he gave him as a hostage to was too soft-hearted to kill the kid, which is why England doesn't belong to France, because William Marshall, as an adult, was the one who got the French out of England after King John died. But that's a long story. I don't know how many people know that when King John of England died, there was a French army commanded by the Dauphin sitting in London. A little bit of interesting history, but that's a digression. And if I have too many digressions, I'll run out of time. Too few and you get bored. So the other things you can do, suppose there is no way of structuring the contract such that you are sure that neither party will ever have an incentive to pull out. In that case, you want to structure it so the party who might have an incentive to pull out is the one most restrained by reputational enforcement. So if one of you is a repeat player, not with me, but with many other people, and therefore has a reputation, then we arrange it so that you can make money by cheating me once, but that'll destroy your reputation. Suppose neither of us has a reputation. Then you find a third party with a reputation who holds the bond. And in fact, as you may know, going back to cyberspace, eBay does this. Part of the way eBay works is by a escrow agent. So I buy something from you, and I've never seen you before, and I am not sure if it's really what it claims to be. It claims to be a 16th century painting, and I'm afraid it might be a fake. So you don't send it to me. You send it to an escrow agent. I inspect it at the escrow agent. If I think it's a fake, he sends it back to you. If it's real, I pay the money and he releases it to me. That's using a third party's reputation, because it depends on trusting the escrow agent, otherwise he could just seize the painting. But that's a way in which if neither party has a reputation, you can leverage a third party's reputation in order to enforce it. So I think all of those give you at least a slight idea. You get more details if you want by going on my webpage and looking at the article from Imperial China to Cyberspace. It's a published article, but most of my published stuff is also available to read for free on my webpage, except when my publisher doesn't let me, which occasionally they don't. And when I'm not clever enough to trick the publisher into letting me in advance. That's another story which I won't tell you. All right, let me now go on to what I think most people would see as the hardest problem, and that is how you could replace the equivalent of criminal and civil law in a society without a government, in what I think of as a proprietarian anarchist society, a society with private property, with trade, but with no government. And to begin with, it's worth noting that a good deal of private law enforcement of various sorts already occurs. For example, the legal code of an arbitrator. That's creating a law, namely the rules by which he will decide disputes. Similarly, every contract is creating a legal code, a little tiny legal code for those two people, because it specifies what will happen according to what we do. But there are also much larger systems of private law, namely systems of private norms. There are lots of things that it is legal to do, but that sensible people don't do, because of the expected response of other people. The example I usually give in class is that it would be perfectly legal for me to teach the class stripped naked to the waist, but in fact I won't do it, and it would be very foolish of me to do it. It would have negative consequences for me. That's a system of private norms. There's a very interesting book by Robert Ellickson, a Yale law professor, called Order Without Law, which describes a system of private law a couple of hours from where I live in modern California, in Shasta County. It's a rural county, where there are norms of neighborly behavior which trump the laws of the state of California. And the reason they trump the laws of the state of California for certain issues, they don't cover murder, for example, but for certain issues, is that one of the strong norms of neighborly behavior is that neighbors don't sue neighbors. So if we are having a conflict and you act correctly according to the norms of neighborly behavior but incorrectly according to the law of California and I sue you, I will lose more than I gain, because I may win in the court, but I will lose in the court of local public opinion, which is probably more important to me. So all of that exists. But let me go through now a full-scale version of private law, which was the subject of part three of my first book, The Machinery of Freedom, which, as you know, has been translated into Italian. I should say I have not read the Italian translation. If any of you have read both the English and the Italian translation, you can tell me afterwards how reliable it is. There was once a French translation of that book, and I got my hands on it before it was published, but after it was done, and wrote them about a 15-page anguished letter listing all of the mistakes in the translation. And I've never had the courage to look at the published version and see whether or not they fixed them. So I may try to get my daughter to read the Italian translation, because unlike me, her Italian is quite good, and she also knows the original. In any case, in that book, part of what I was trying to do was to see if you could carry the case for laissez-faire all the way. Because classical liberals have a problem. which some of them are not aware of. And the problem is that they believe that government is very bad at doing things like feeding people or building cars or writing books or all sorts of other things. And that the solution is to have all those things done by private people with institutions of private property and trade. And these institutions are to be controlled by a legal system which is created and run by this government that's incompetent to do complicated things. Now, creating a legal system is not a trivial problem. I don't know if probably a few of you are lawyers, and if so, you know better than other people do that although it's really easy if you're not a lawyer to say, well, the law should be such and such, it's perfectly obvious, it turns out that it's much, much more complicated. It's sort of where the rubber hits the road, as it were. The world is a complicated place. So if the government isn't competent to build cars, it probably isn't competent to make laws either. And yet classical liberals are relying on the government to do that part of the job, and they've had a lot of disappointments over the last century or maybe longer. So what I wanted to see was whether you could carry it all the way and use this, roughly the same mechanisms we use to build good cars, to build good laws, the same mechanisms we use to feed us, to protect us. And so I sketched out a hypothetical future set of institutions, which went as follows. There is no government. There are private firms that sell the service of rights enforcement and dispute settlement to their customers. And this raises an obvious problem, which everybody sees when you describe such a system. What happens when there's a conflict between me and you, and we have different rights enforcement firms? So that I think you stole my television, you claim you didn't. My rights enforcement agency is planning to send some tough guys to take the television back, and you say, well, if they do, your agency will send more tough guys to defend you. There will be a war between the agencies. That sounds very unpleasant, expensive, risky, and so forth. But it sounds unpleasant and risky to the agencies, too. These are profit-making firms, not governments. They only have customers if customers choose to hire their services. So they have a strong incentive to find less expensive ways of settling disputes. And the first time it comes up, the obvious answer is arbitration. But once they recognize that this problem is going to occur again and again, because I'm imagining two agencies which operate in the same area, now it is in their interest to contract, to agree on a private court which will arbitrate any dispute between their customers, and to both agree that they will accept the decisions of that court. So if the court says you did steal my television set, your agency won't protect you when my people come to take it back. Now you might say, but what enforces this contract? We have no government, we've got no courts. Ah, but we have the discipline of constant dealing because these two agencies are repeat players. It is obvious to each of them that if it reneges on the agreement the first time the court decides against its customer, then the agreement is done and it is back trying to handle things by impromptu arbitration or by fighting each other. And it will then lose customers to other agencies that behave more reasonably. So that, I think, solves the fundamental problem, as it were, of how you can produce law and law enforcement on the market. Now, where is the law coming from? The law is coming from the private courts. The private courts, however, are producing law on the market to sell. That is to say, each court wants agencies to agree to use it. Each agency wants its customers to agree to be customers of that agency. And part of the product the agency is selling is the legal rules that it uses. Notice this is not a uniform legal system. In principle, the rules between every pair of agencies could be different. There will probably be some pressure towards uniformity as in other market contexts, some degree of standardization, but not perfect standardization. What kind of law will we get? I want to imagine that one agency has customers who are in favor of the death penalty and one agency has customers who are against the death penalty. So customers of the first agency say, I'm sure that I will never murder anybody. I trust the court never to convict me of a murder I don't commit. So there's no cost and I want to make sure that I don't get killed by making sure that anybody who kills me will get executed. The customers of the other agency have the opposite set of beliefs for whatever reason. So the agencies have to bargain over the court. And so the first agency goes to its customers and it does some market research. The question is, how much more would they pay for its services if it could guarantee capital punishment in a dispute with the other agency? $200,000. The second agency does the same kind of market research. $300,000. Well, result is pretty obvious. One agency makes a side payment of $250,000 to the other, and you agree not to have capital punishment. Or alternatively, on some other disputed point, the agencies agree the other way. Now, there are various complications. Some of you may know that Jim Buchanan died recently. He was a colleague of mine. He also wrote the only good review my book got, where I define a good review as a review that makes the author think. And that review raised some interesting problems, which I'm not discussing tonight because that would be another talk, but you can find that other talk if you go up on my webpage, where I've got recordings, some of them video and some of them audio, of lots of my talks. And with a little effort, you can find my discussion of some further complications in this issue. But for the moment, the bottom line of what I'm arguing is that the legal system I'm describing will tend to get what an economist would call efficient law. That is, law which maximizes some benefits to all affected, because that's going to determine how much people are willing to bid to get the law they want. And that's a slight oversimplification, as I say. If you look at the talk, which is called something like Towards a Third Edition of Machinery of Freedom, you will find some qualifications to that statement. But it's at least approximately right. So that means it'll have a tendency, just as markets tend to produce the cars people want, it'll tend to produce the laws people want. And it has a number of important advantages for doing this over political mechanisms. One of them is that in a democratic political system, the sort of what I think of as the civics class model of democracy, the sort of simple theory of why democracy is supposed to work, is that the politicians have to do good things, otherwise you'll vote them out. And in order for that to work, the voters have to know both what the politicians are doing and whether it's good. Neither of those is easy. For some odd reason, politicians never campaign saying, I'm the bad guy. Furthermore, as far as I know, nobody has ever introduced a bill into the US Congress labeled a bill to make farmers richer and city folks poorer. Every year, such a bill is introduced to Congress. It's called the Farm Program or the Agriculture Bill. Its purpose is to raise the price of farm products. You may be familiar with similar patterns in Europe. I think even worse here. But that's not what they call it. They always have some covering explanation of why it's good for everybody that food be expensive. So that means that in order for the civics class model to work, many, many voters have got to be paying enough attention to figure out what laws are good or bad and to figure out what their particular representative is doing. What's the payoff? Economists believe in rational behavior. Why should people choose to acquire this information? Why do we elect good politicians? And if I acquire the information, how much more likely is it that the good politician will win? About one chance in 5 million. That is to say, in a presidential election in the US, very, very roughly, the chance that one vote will be decisive is somewhere around 1 in 5 million. It is not worth spending very much on research for one chance in 5 million of getting a better politician. So the result is what economists who study the political system refer to as rational ignorance. It is rational to be ignorant when the information costs more than it is worth. And for almost all voters considered as voters, it is rational to be ignorant. Now, there may be other contexts. If you're lobbying for your industry and you're in a position not to decide who gets elected, but to decide what campaign donations go to a congressman who will vote for what you want, now it pays not to be ignorant. But for simple majority vote making them do good things, rational ignorance makes it work very poorly. Now compare that to my system. In my system, as in markets in general, you get what you choose. If I say, now I don't have a complete choice, because after all, I can only use courts that other people have agreed to. But among the rights enforcement agencies, one of whose features is which laws they've bargained for, I get to choose the one I want, and I get 100% chance, if I decide that one is better than this one, I get 100% chance of getting it. Just like if I decide that a Honda is better than a Toyota, I get 100% chance of getting a Honda. I don't have to vote and hope that my vote will change which car we get. So one reason then is that in my system, the individuals have a greater incentive to acquire information. And the second is that the information is more readily available because you can actually compare alternatives. We will know what happened under the Obama administration of the past 4 years. And Obama's supporters will say, yes, it went pretty badly, but we were faced with terrible circumstances that would have gone even worse with McCain. We will never know. We'll never know what the McCain administration would have been like. Similarly for all past experiences. I am sure there are people here who think that Berlusconi was a terrible head of state, and people who think he was a good head of state, and none of them can prove it. Because none of them can point at the alternative history of Italy that would have happened if somebody else had been in power. But you can test drive a Toyota and test drive a Honda and see which one you like better. You can even test drive a Fiat and see if you like that one better. Let me be fair. I happen to like Japanese cars. You can test drive a Mac and test drive a Windows machine. For some reason, you wanted to try a Windows machine. This is one of the great divisions of the modern world, as of course you know. It's almost as big as the division between football teams in Italy. Therefore, in what I'm arguing is that the institutions I describe have the virtue that there is an incentive to make good law, a private profit-making incentive by the people making the law, which doesn't exist at present. There is an incentive to do a good job of judging the law. Currently, if a judge makes a bad verdict which has terrible results, and I could give you my favorite example, I won't at the moment, but it was a mistake that a smart high school student should have been ashamed of, and it probably killed a couple of thousand people, U.S. case. Judge suffers no penalty at all for that. And it is a mechanism where the information necessary to choose is relatively available, more available in the political system. There are obviously lots of potential questions that one can ask about how it would work. You can find some of them answered in The Machinery of Freedom, some of them in other talks of mine which you can find on the web, some of them in written material on my website. My website is www.daviddfriedman.com, so it's easy to remember. You just need that, it's all one word, you just need the extra D, which is my middle initial, and I need it because I applied for my site about 3 months too late. 3 months earlier, I could have gotten davidfriedman.com, but alas, there are too many David Friedmans out there, and one of them beat me to it. But www.daviddfriedman.com, and you will find the English version of Machinery of Freedom available as a free PDF to download, and you will find lots of my essays, several of my other books that you may find of interest, and lots of other stuff. All right, I think that's really as much as I want to say in my part of the talk tonight. I concluded a long time ago that the great advantage of a question period is that when you're answering a question, you can be reasonably sure that at least one person in the audience is interested in what you're talking about. So let me now terminate my part and turn it over to you.
Prego, Eugenio Smaini.
You think that